From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, those open lines. Here's what's happening. The U.S. labor market firing on all cylinders in May. The unemployment rate fell to an 18-year low. Employers adding jobs at a faster pace and wages modestly improved. The unemployment rate ticked down to a seasonally adjusted 3.8%, matching April of 2000 as the lowest reading since 1969. Amazing. In Denver, an Uber driver was taken into custody after his passenger was shot and killed. Michael Andre Hancock, a 29-year-old man, was being held in jail for investigation of first-degree murder. According to a probable cause statement issued by police, Denver 911 received a call about 2:45 in the morning from a man on an Interstate 25 ramp who said there was a guy, an Uber driver, who said his ride tried to attack him and that the driver shot him. President Trump said that a high-stakes summit between him and Kim Jong-un is back on for June 12th following a lengthy meeting with a top North Korean official in the Oval Office. That's good news. Let's check in with John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. John, that is good news. It was a good news day today, wasn't it? Oh, no John Curtis. He is not there. Well, I know John would have said that is good news, that they're finally going to meet, and they've decided to do that. Roughly 50 years after the death of Robert F. Kennedy, the busboy who held the dying senator detailed his last words at a Friday report. Juan Romero, who was 17 during the 1969 incident, if you remember the picture of Robert Kennedy lying on the floor and the little busboy standing by him, was working on that early June night when the presidential hopeful made remarks at the Ambassador Hotel in California. After Kennedy spoke, he was reportedly ushered through the hotel's kitchen where he paused to greet employees, including Romero. I remember extending my hand as far as I could, and then I remember him shaking my hand, Romero reportedly said during the interview, and as he let go, somebody shot him. Romero is now 67, and he recalled Kennedy's final words. Here they are. Is everyone okay? That's what he asked Romero. Romero said yes before cushioning the senator's head with his hands. Google came under fire after an error in its knowledge panel listed Nazism as the ideology of the California Republican Party. The error, which was first spotted by a political strategist, showed that Nazism, alongside other ideologies such as conservatism, market liberalism, fiscal conservatism, and green conservatism, were there. But what does it all mean? Lauren Weinstein from the Internet Expert. Lauren, what is this?
Well, let me start with my disclaimer that I have consulted to Google, but everything I'm going to say here is, of course, public information.
Okay.
All right, let's start with a general case here. There's this big lie fallacy that Google is manipulating search results and posts to suppress conservative points of view. That's why we heard from, I think, the House Majority Leader was screaming about this particular case you mentioned. Donald Trump Jr. was talking about it. It's nonsense. It's nonsense because if you think about it, Google operates at an enormous scale. It's mind-boggling scale. All of the work that's done for the knowledge panels, those are the answer boxes that are at the top or the right, above or to the right of the ordinary search results. It's all done by algorithms. And it's entirely within Google's rights to want to keep hate speech off of their platform.
Well, of course. I don't blame them.
And because, you know, people say, well, what about the First Amendment? First Amendment, as we know, only applies to government actions. It doesn't control what an individual or a corporation can do. So what happens with Google is if there's hate speech, whether it's racist or sexist, anti-Semitic, whatever it is, regardless of the political party, the political inclinations of the person who's making that kind of post, it's going to be removed. And that's going to happen by those algorithms. So it's not a political bias. It's an anti-hate speech algorithm, and it's completely appropriate. Now, in the case we're talking about right now, this case of the California Republican Party getting the Nazi tag, the reason that happens is that the knowledge panels are generated mostly from third-party sources. In other words, Google relies on third-party sites that supposedly have trusted information to generate those kinds of answers. One of the sites that Google depends on heavily for this purpose is Wikipedia. Now, I'm not a big fan of Wikipedia. Part of the reason for this is because there's a lot of mutation of their pages. Pages can be defaced, there's editing wars, and there can be periods where bad information is on those pages, just wrong information. That's what happened in this case. It wasn't Google saying that the California GOP were Nazis. It was someone who defaced a Wikipedia page. And while Google has mechanisms in those algorithms that tries to keep that kind of Wikipedia noise, those kinds of errors from getting onto Google pages, nothing's perfect. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened to this case. It sat there for some amount of time on the Wikipedia page. Apparently no one noticed. No one bothered to fix it. And during that period, Google sucked in that data, and that's how it ended up on that page.
Unbelievable. Thank you, Lauren. I appreciate it. Dr. John Curtis is back with us, onlinecolonist.com. Where were you? Out getting a sandwich or what, John?
No, I mean, we just got completely cut off, just zipped. You know, I'm on a cell phone tonight. But I just want to say this about the Bobby Kennedy thing, because I think his son, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., is out there saying that there are more bullets than he thinks, because Trey, the guy that was actually hit by one of the bullets that night, believes that there were up to 13 bullets that were fired, not right. eight out of the revolver that Sirhan Sirhan had. But remember, George, that Rafer Johnson, who was Olympic decathlete, very famous guy doing acting at the time, wrestled Sirhan Sirhan to the ground that night and held his hand, you know, got the gun loose and held him down until the police could apprehend him. They all witnessed, numerous people witnessed, eyewitness reports of him discharging eight bullets into Bobby Kennedy. So it's not like the JFK assassination where nobody saw Oswald pull the trigger and there was just wild speculation coming from all sides. And what Sirhan Sirhan's testimony, you know, Bobby Kennedy Jr., Robert Kennedy Jr. Interviewed him, you know, back in December, and was told by Sirhan, 74 years of age, probably schizophrenic, that he didn't murder his father.
Yeah, he doesn't remember it anymore at this point.
No, he has no recollection. But he was identified by psychiatrists, independent psychiatrists at the time of the murder, as schizophrenic. So I don't think he's a very credible witness. Now, as far as Trump is concerned, in this new summit, I think the important thing to take from this is extremely bad news to some people, George.
How come?
Summit. It's catastrophic news for the Democratic Party heading into the midterm elections. If Trump gets a successful beginning of a potential peace treaty with North Korea, it completely upends the Mueller investigation, really diverts the attention. He probably wins a Nobel Peace Prize along with Kim Jong-un
right.
if they can develop a peace treaty.
If they can, that's true.
And so if you really look at the negative press that's coming from all quarters over the summit, talking about, oh, he's not really getting denuclearization, he's reversed his position, you know, he's changed his tune now, I think what it shows is the Democratic Party being and the media that backs them, which is just about everyone except for Fox News, that this is very threatening to their plan to take over the House and Senate in November.
Good point. John, thank you. Enjoy the weekend, my friend. I will be at Contact in the Desert this weekend. A couple panels. I'm looking forward to that. As molten lava continues spewing from Hawaii's Kilauea volcano, the Hawaii County has ordered all residents of a designated portion of the hard-hit Lalani Estates development to evacuate or face possible arrest. They're getting serious there. A semi-truck carrying a reported 15 to 30 million honeybees overturned on an East Texas highway a few days ago. It happened on the Southeast Loop 286 near the old Clarksville Road intersection in Paris, Texas. Jeez. Could you imagine 30 million honeybees flying all over the place? What else is flying all over the place? Let's check in with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center for his weekly report. Peter, what do we have?
Yeah, good evening, George. I'll probably hear about some of those bees before the weekend is over.
Probably.
Well, with the help of a very dedicated webmaster, I've been able to update the UFO Center website twice in the last 2 days, and there's currently a rich crop of approximately 130 nice reports now posted there. I'd like to address four of them tonight.
Sure thing. Go ahead.
The first report was submitted by a business executive who reports that on Tuesday morning, May 15th, at approximately 03:30 hours, he was driving near Jackson Hole, Wyoming, on his way to catch an early morning flight out of Idaho Falls. His attention was suddenly drawn to a cluster of three very brightly lighted white objects, each about the size of a compact car, he estimated, so pretty sizable. Moving very rapidly, again, he estimates moving at perhaps 150 miles an hour or so, and not more than 100 feet above the tops of some local rugged terrain. As he was mentally processing that first scene, he suddenly became aware that now there was a second group of identical objects following the first group, except the second group of the objects was arranged in a straight line rather than in a cluster of objects, oriented nose to tail, each about 100 feet from its neighbor, he estimated. I can assure you, George, that if I'd been there, if I'd been he, I would have been turned around and headed back home by this time, but we're not done yet. The witness reported that the first two groups of white lights were then followed by yet two more groups of similar-looking objects, save for the fact that they were a vivid red color. Very, very peculiar sighting and very dramatic, and the witness appears to be quite reliable. The second report comes from London, Ontario, Canada, and it describes an event that's somewhat reminiscent of the Jackson Hole sighting that I just described.
Mm-hmm.
A businesswoman reports that at approximately 11:56 p.m. on the 30th of May, so just two nights ago, she was looking to the eastern sky and suddenly became aware of six identical-looking objects, each of which looked something like a parasail-style hang glider, and all exhibiting solid white lights, but no blinking or strobing lights on them. They were moving very quickly from the eastern to the southern sky, so from her left to right as she faced the east. When the objects arrived in the southern sky, they suddenly executed a pronounced turn to the northwest, accelerated, and disappeared in the western sky. Very interesting sighting. And to close, George, I think I'll make it three reports tonight instead of four. This one risks having me explosively defenestrated from the second floor of the Coast Studios, given that I've spoken about this type of event so often.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a good one, and I feel duty-bound to share it with the Coast audience. For the past three nights, there have been very dramatic sightings of clusters of orange lights in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. excuse me, they're far too long for me to describe here tonight, but I encourage people who are interested in the fireball phenomenon to go to the UFO Center website and read those reports. Some of the witnesses are very convincing, very credible, and it was a very dramatic sighting three nights in a row. It's being covered by some brave journalists there in the Myrtle Beach area. Anyway, that's my report for tonight, George, and I'm sticking to every word of it.
Thank you, Peter. Love your reports. Up next, ghosts, seances, and tales of true hauntings as we enter Varla Ventura's Paranormal Parlor next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. So what would a Friday night be if we didn't talk a little bit about ghosts, some seances, and some other true hauntings? And who better than Varla Ventura? And her latest work is Varla Ventura's Paranormal Parlor. And here she is back on Coast to Coast. Varla, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me back, George. Great to hear your voice again.
Now, I remember my grandmother telling me when I was a kid that the parlor was like the living room of most other houses, where the family gathered. They didn't have television sets in those days. They did things as a family. They did skits and games. They, you know, had people in. In your parlor, you do seances, ghosts, and hauntings, huh?
Well, I think that's very true, that a parlor is sort of a good way of describing a gathering, a room that is a gathering place. And for many people, it could be around the dining table where they're trying to levitate the table. For others, it's simply a place to swap stories or just sit together as a family and play games. So it makes perfect sense that sort of paranormal games would also start to take place in the parlor, which often became sort of a more formal sitting room. And paranormal, mm-hmm. some of the paranormal parlor activities that were very popular during the sort of Victorian era were done by people of sort of the upper level of society who had this extra room that was set aside for guests. And they would sort of open that their door to guests of the from the other side, as well as people who were interested in the supernatural.
And Varla, because in those days they didn't have a lot of media to entertain themselves. They didn't have social media. They didn't have computers. They didn't have television. They didn't have anything that they could really divert themselves from. So they had to get together as a family, as a group, and they tried to do things. Was it entertaining for them to talk about ghosts and do seances in those days?
Oh, absolutely. Definitely a huge form of it was just pure entertainment. The rise of this sort of like paranormal parlor activity really came during sort of the late Victorian era, so maybe like the 1840s, 1850s, up through about the 1920s. And up until that point, you know, we didn't really have like regular radio. We were corresponding with a paper, or, you know, we'd read a paper once a week, or we would send letters or telegrams. Most people didn't even have telephones. And even after the invention of the telephone, it wasn't a common household thing until later. And of course, there was no television. So you do have people looking for forms of entertainment. People have always tried to make contact with the other side, but the rise of the spiritualist movement from the 1840s through about the 20s really was kind of born on the back of it becoming almost more of an entertainment. And out of that, we did have many, many sort of silly things and charlatans, but we also had some pretty phenomenal mm-hmm. stories and experiences. But it definitely was high entertainment. And this was also the era in which Houdini became famous, other sort of traveling sideshows and circus acts and things of that nature. Those were the height of entertainment during that time.
Well, I could just see them during that time period saying something like, hey, we're going over to Varla's tonight to conjure up some ghosts. I mean, and they probably...
They still say that, George.
Yeah, they do. With you, they do. But they were really, I would guess, very excited about doing things. I remember, Varla, and this is more in a spiritual, religious sense, my grandmother and my mother and her sisters would go to Blessed Virgin Mary statue parties. And somebody would, they'd tag me along. I was like 8 or 9 years old. Somebody would cart in the statue of the Blessed Virgin Mary, and they would all pray, hoping it would cry. And I guess one just did a couple days ago. We have a story on it at coasttocoastam.com. But they would do that, and they'd have this statue. And I got to tell you, as an 8-year-old kid, that scared the living daylights out of me.
That sounds scary.
I mean, I didn't want to see some statue cry, and I really didn't get, you know, who's the statue of, but they would do that. But I think they also did it for entertainment.
Sure. And what was interesting about the spiritualist movement and sort of like a lot of these seances and sessions with mediums is that they weren't necessarily exclusive to people who weren't religious. In fact, it was often people who were very open-minded and considered themselves, you know, stalwart Christians. So it wasn't necessarily like, oh, we have people on one side of the fence that believe in, you know, the Virgin Mary, and we have people that believe in ghosts. It was all, well, of course, I think people who believe in Virgin Mary do believe in ghosts, of course.
Probably.
Yeah. But you had people of varying backgrounds. Most of the people who were heavily involved in it were people of a higher socioeconomic status because they were the ones with the time to sort of make that form of entertainment. And, you know, I remember also my own grandparents doing things like that. You know, they were always sitting around the table and playing cards with their friends, but they used to, now they were deaf. Both of them were deaf, and my grandfather was a deaf mute. So they would have their deaf friends over, and they would gather around the table. And my mom remembers this very clearly, even from when she was a little girl, that they would regularly do, like, psychic parlor tricks. They would all try and – they would all, like, think of one thing that they agreed upon, mm-hmm. and then they would try and get one of the kids to guess what it was. Like, my uncle would say, oh, you know, it was a red ball or whatever.
Hold on for a second, Varla. I want to talk more about that, and, of course, we'll be back with Varla Ventura. Her new book is called Varla Ventura's Paranormal Parlor. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We will have open lines later on in the program for you. We will take calls next hour with Varla Ventura as we talk about her new work, Varla Ventura's Paranormal Parlor, and you can share some of your stories with us as well, too. Well, here's some exciting news, of course. If you've been listening to us for the last couple of months here with regards to our live stage shows, Las Vegas, it is next Saturday now, right around the corner at the Silverton Casino in Las Vegas. A few tickets left, and I mean just a few. Go to our website, click events at the top of the homepage, or it's in the carousel reel, and you'll click that. It'll take you straight to the Silverton Casino, and you can get your tickets. Come on out. We're going to have a meet and greet after the event, special guests, live band. It's just a great time. We have a lot of fun doing that. Las Vegas next Saturday, June 9th. And then, of course, Saturday, August 25th. You think you still have time to get tickets? Well, don't wait too long. We're going back to Asheville, North Carolina at the Diana Wortham Theater. So go to DWTheater, theatre.com, and put my name in the events, and then just click away. It'll take you there. Or go to coasttocoastam.com, and again, click events at the top of the homepage. And we are back with Varla Ventura. We're talking about her latest work called Paranormal Parlor. Her website is hername.net, linked up at coasttocoastam.com, by the way. And Varla, of course, is not related to Ace Ventura. I've always wanted to say that to you, Varla. Always.
I constantly get asked if I'm related to Jesse Ventura.
Uh-huh.
People always want to know that.
That's more doable.
Asked me that today.
Jesse's a good guy. He's one of a kind. We've talked many times on this program before, and I've been on one of his radio shows a long time ago. He's a good guy, tough guy, former wrestler, governor of Minnesota.
Yeah.
And he's doing his thing. So let's talk about the book, and let's talk about some of the collection of the ghost stories, haunted places, and ghoulish stories that you were able to get. How'd you find them?
Well, it's a collection of stories of experiences that have happened to me. There's a few old stories that I really loved. For example, a story by a man named Ralph Adams Cram, who was this famous architect who had this secret life as a horror writer and wrote this really particularly beautiful story about sort of a strange ritual room in Paris. And it's just incredible detail. Because he was an architect, he's describing, you know, 1800s Paris and this kind of ornate apartment of his, you know, some school chum's aunt who has a sort of strange room in the back. So there's a few things like that. And then I just went to some of my, you know, favorite people who had told me stories over time, including some people that I'm sure you've had as guests on your show or I had been guests on their show, and we had sort of talked offline after. So I was able to include some of their stories and their experiences. And one thing that I noticed happened quite frequently, because I love including people's stories, and actually many times when I've been on Coast to Coast, like with my first book, The Book of the Bizarre, you had me on, and after that, so many people contacted me and shared their stories. I was able to include them in the next book, which was a really great experience, and so thanks for that.
Well, that's okay. Hey, we've got a very interactive audience. They really get involved.
Yes. For better or for worse, that is very, very true. but yes, absolutely. So, and also, you know, one of my favorite parts of Coast to Coast has always been, since I was a younger and would listen to it, were always the callers and the stories that the people would share. Those were always the eeriest things as you're, you know, maybe you're on the road driving late at night and you're listening to Coast and you hear these, you know, this trucker calls in with this thing he saw alongside the road. So I've always appreciated stories that have that. But so it's kind of there's a combination of a couple of stories that I begged off of people and stories that people were willing to share with me. and over again, I saw, especially with people who had been in the paranormal field for many years, I saw a pattern in which what the story that they shared with me was sort of their first experience with a ghost. That wasn't always the case, but in several cases, they said, you know, you asked me to share the story, and I decided that I wanted to share the first time, because in some cases, many of these people were a bit skeptical, or maybe they were even sort of interested, but they had never had the experience themselves. And so to me, that was really interesting to kind of see that turning point when they went beyond just being a collector and an investigator and had had the experience themselves to sort of that they couldn't explain away or to kind of authenticate their point of view. So that was really incredible honor and treat to have that in there. And then, of course, just a lot of research of creepy haunted hotels and old
institutions.
Yes, there are many. And then just classic haunted house stories, things of that nature.
Let's go through a couple of stories. Not going to do all of them because I want people to read your book. That's the whole purpose of it. But give us one of your favorites that scared the living daylights out of you.
Okay. So one of the scariest ones was actually, there's a number that frightened me. I had a couple of experiences. In general, my personal experiences were relatively benign. They were definitely something happened, mm-hmm. but I never felt frightened in any of the sort.
Or threatened, I guess.
I guess threatened would be a better way. I never felt threatened. I never felt that menacing was after me, or, you know, there was something that I needed to really be afraid of. In fact, I found time and time again when I have had sort of a supernatural experience or what I think of as a paranormal experience, in that moment, I'm not thinking it's a paranormal experience. I'm not thinking, oh, my gosh, that's a ghost. I'm thinking logically. I'm trying to explain it away scientifically every way that I can. And I think that happens to a lot of people. And then after the fact, you realize you just can't match everything up. Or something dawns on you like, wait, oh, I don't have a cat. That can't be a cat pressing at the foot of my bed. But one of the most frightening stories was a story that my friend told me, a lifelong friend, somebody that, you know, you want on your side if Armageddon hits.
Yeah.
You want him to draw his sword. This is not somebody who's afraid of many things in life, but has had a few pretty significant experiences in his life that have led him to understand that there is something kind of more out there.
And some close calls, I bet.
And some close calls, absolutely. Yeah. And this particular one took place, and as a teaser, I'll just say it's he calls it the incident at Indian Springs. I call it the thing that moaned in the woods. And it's got a bit of a Lovecraftian sort of element to it, in which he experienced a sound of a creature that he had never heard before and had never heard since. And that was certainly not by any means human or possibly even animal.
Hmm. Was it like a Bigfoot scream or something like that we hear so much about?
So it was a classic alone on a piece of rural property. Dusk, the light is sort of fading, and he's been working on the property. He's clearing the property. He's going to build a house there eventually, and he settles down to sort of, there's sort of like a little cabin structure on the property that he can sleep in while he, you know, gets up, and it's not a really solid place to stay, but it's somewhere that he can stay when he's been working all day and then, you know, doesn't need to go back to his place at night. So he settles in, and I need to just preface this with saying that this is a piece of property. He grew up on this land his whole life.
So he knows it like the back of his hand.
Right, and we all have had that, too, where it's like, you know, we know those strange sounds in the night. We know the sound of the animals braying down in the valley below. We know, you know, the echoes. We know our neighbors. You get to know these sounds. The way he described it was basically just that it was this incredibly low moan that was so low and it sort of hit him in a way that you might hit, you know, like somebody singing a very, very low tone. It just struck him. He thought, you know, is somebody playing a synthesizer or something?
Really? And was it like traveling guttural? A guttural like type song?
Yes, very, very. He described it as being even lower than like a baritone, just like extremely low and actually rattling things on the shelves in this little cabin that he was in. And the part that was particularly frightening is that he hears this sound. He's just kind of settling in. He's inside. He hears this sound, and he can hear it. And, you know, first he's thinking, is it some kind of donkey or some kind of animal? And, you know, is it in heat? Is it dying? Is it the sound just carrying up? And then the sound just stops. And when it stops, there's no echo. There's no continuation of the sound. It's just completely truncated. No sound. And then it starts up again, and it's closer.
Is he getting scared at this point?
At this point, he's starting to, this, when it got, when he heard it the second time, and it sounded closer and louder, and things were really starting to rattle, and it almost felt like, you know, earthquake status. He knew something was out there, but he didn't. He still was trying to sort of logically explain it away. It ended again. And then a third time, it started up again, and this time it was so close that, I mean, he couldn't even bring himself to get up and look outside. And so here is this man who's, you know, he's an archaeologist, he's traveled the world, he's gone through, you know, spelunking in underground caverns and very adventurous and done many things, and he doesn't even want to open his door on his childhood property.
He's probably had bats fly out at him and stuff like that.
Things that would make, you know, an average person cringe, he just takes in stride. And that's part of what really frightened me about the story. And also, he told me while I was on the property and it was getting dark. So that was like, oh, okay. And then I had to go sleep in that little cabin. So.
Oh, great.
Yeah, great. What am I going to hear? And the other thing is that when I first asked him about it, he didn't necessarily give me all, he didn't really want to talk about it. So I knew it had really rattled him. So, of course, I just harassed him privately until he finally told me what had happened. And it turned out also that a neighbor, the night following that, had heard a similar sound followed by a splash into his pond. And there's many more little details to the story that I've put them all in the book because he actually wrote down the whole story for me.
And clearly there wasn't somebody playing a game with him, right?
You know, we talked about all the possibilities. You know, could it have been something from, you know, the nearby Air Force Base? Could it have been something from an animal? Could it have been just like, yeah, could it have been a prank? It would have been a pretty elaborate prank because the sound kept getting closer and closer. And I just think it became one of those things where we would probably not know. Now, the other thing that's interesting is at this time, I was actually just finishing my book about banshees. And to me, it sounded like many of the stories that I had heard of sort of like warning ghosts or banshee screams or the idea that this creature was coming, like, you know, giving some kind of howl or warning, less so than like a Bigfoot or something like that, although, of course, that's always a possibility. But to me, it sounded more, even more supernatural than that, like something that was giving off a signal of some kind.
And what exactly is a banshee for people who don't know?
So banshee is an Irish fairy that also sort of fits in the category, straddles the world of the ghost.
And it's female generally. Isn't it?
Always female.
Yeah.
Always female. And exists to as a warning of or a portent of death or grave illness.
Before something happens,
always warning. And in many cultures around the world, we have warning ghosts or incidents where people will hear something or see something, and it will be supposed to be a warning signal.
She's a precursor of doom.
Yes, but the banshee in particular is it's an Irish word meaning of the fairy mound.
What do they look like?
They're often beautiful, and at first, so you'll see a beautiful woman walking along the road. Sometimes they'll also appear as a helpless old lady or like a little sort of a hag with, you know, just kind of hobbling along the road that you want to like, oh, can I
help you,
with your basket? Yes. And then they'll turn and they become sort of this teeth gnashing, sunken eyes.
Do they try to hurt you? Do they try to physically hurt you?
There are some accounts of banshees causing mayhem and driving people mad to the point where they might, you know, accidentally leap off a cliff. But there aren't very many encounters with a banshee where the banshee itself is going to physically touch you or cause the harm. But the problem is that it's not usually the person who sees the banshee who dies. It's usually someone they love, and that's what makes it particularly frightening. And the banshees initially were sort of inherited from Irish clans, and different clans had their own banshees. And then as people migrated and the population became less, you know, specific to the clans, some people still retained, either they carried the banshee with them, or they maintained the sight, which allowed them to see the banshee. Either way you look at it, they still, it was common to have it be a generational experience where one person in a generation.
Does something, Varla, always happen after somebody has witnessed or seen a banshee?
Yes.
And it's always bad?
Yes.
Is it necessarily bad to the person or bad to an event? I mean, for example, did a lot of people see banshees before 9/11? Even though they may not have been involved in it, they may not have been there, but did they see, you know, these kinds of entities?
You know, that's a great question. I don't know. Most of the banshee stories tend to be from parts of like Ireland, and then there's some in Wales. But there are in the United States equivalents, and there certainly are many, many stories, and many people out there have had these stories where they have had a visitation of some kind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, I guess my question is, if you see the banshee, are you the one that's going to face this doom and gloom?
No, probably not.
Okay, so it's
probably going to be someone you love.
Somebody you care about, somebody you know. Okay.
Yeah.
And how do you warn them? You can't, because you don't know what's going to happen,
do
you?
Nothing you can do. You just have to, you know, make sure your affairs are in order and you kiss the people you love and wonder what it was that you saw.
Jeez. And how does the banshee disappear when their job is done?
Well, they just sort of appear and then disappear, or you might run screaming and then they just, you know, cackle off into the night. There's a lot of different experiences where people open the door and they see one. They're walking along the road and they encounter one.
Well, let's get some calls. Let's keep talking about your book, but maybe some people have seen banshees or other stories like this, and they can share them with us.